thought it was record.
We're recording.
You're recording.
We are making a record of it. We're recording. This is Task Time Energy, the Purpose-Filled Productivity Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Welcome to the show. Welcome, everyone. Our guest today is Chris Ryan. Chris is CEO and co-founder of Silver Quicken. And I love, Chris, this description on your website. It says, "We are a team of teachers, parents, and education industry veterans, bringing our greatest skills and efforts to bear on a common purpose, igniting wonder and joy in education." So,
Thanks. Yeah, that's our mission and our vision. So, and who we are. Yeah.
And we definitely want to talk a little bit more about Silver Quicken and exactly what it is and exactly what you do. Just want to share a little bit of your background, your interesting background with people. So you have a BA in physics from Harvard University. You taught high school physics and chemistry for a while. You have an MBA from the Duke Fuqua School of Business.
Well said. It is Fuqua, and they taught us that. It was such a silly thing because it's pronounced in different ways. There's like Fuqua Verena. You know, and of course we deliberately mispronounced it all the time. And I won't share all the pronunciations. And that is an example of the way I think divergently, which is such a struggle for time management. Please go on.
You have an extensive experience in the test preparation world, and that's actually how we met. And I may tell a little short story about that. But before we do, I'd love to know what else, like fill us in a little more. Tell us a little bit more, because every time we get together, or almost every time, you mention something about your background, your education background, work experience or something. And I go, wow, that is so interesting. So I'd just love to hear you talk for however long you want about a little bit about your background. And then tell us more about Silver Quicken.
Sure. Let's see. When I was a little kid, I kept trying to control the wind. I had written a story about the Wind Lord, and then I tried to be the Wind Lord, which meant that I put my fingers out to the sky and to the trees. And of course, what would happen is a little breeze would go by and the leaves would go. And I'd be like, that was me. I did that. And then like it wouldn't happen. And then I'd be like, you know, it was such a case of like non-cause effect relationship, but I was reading into the patterns. I didn't turn that into a career exactly. Being a wind controller, it kind of stopped working so well. So I don't think I've ever talked about that really with I don't know anyone, Scott. So you've managed to pierce to something pretty deep. I don't know what that means, that particular Wind Lord thing, but like sort of a dreamer side of me and looking for, you know, joy and wonder in the world, that sort of thing. I'm totally inspired by Tolkien and Ursula K. Le Guin and all this kind of science fiction and fantasy as a kid and continue to be. That's actually a little part of that is in Silver Quicken. Some other things, I biked around Ireland when I was 14 with my older brother, and we set up our bikes in Shannon Airport, like in the baggage check area, because that's where the boxes with our bikes in them came through. And we put our bikes together and left the cardboard boxes there in that little area and rode off. And we were a little worried, like 3 weeks later, what would happen when we came back? We didn't have other bike boxes. You can't carry a bike box with you. And to cut to the chase, when we got back, one of the boxes was still there. One of them was gone, but it had been replaced by a different box. Which I remember was kind of more beaten up, and we were kind of confused by that. So whoever out there, if you're listening, thank you for that bike box. We rode from Shannon Airport out to a little seaside town called Doolin, and there caught a ferry out to the smallest of the Aran Islands called Inishir, which means East Island in Irish Gaelic. And that night, in the middle of the night, my brother shook me awake. He's like, I'm so sick. It was something he had eaten. And we got stuck on that island, which this was 1984. In 1969 is when that island got electricity. It's like a couple of square miles. It's technically Galway Bay, but it's pretty exposed to the Atlantic. It's crisscrossed by stone walls everywhere with like little tiny, tiny, tiny fields, like smaller than a room, where you might find one sheep plunked that's kind of like, what am I doing here? And there's some grass growing on soil that had been curred over. The curras were these leather canoes that the islanders, they would bring soil and mix it with seaweed over, and that's how they had grass. So anyway, that next day, my brother was laid up, and there wasn't much to do other than walk around this island, kind of crisscross it, and then talk to people. And that's when I learned my first words in the Irish language, gutamahagut. That's four words, actually, which means thank you. May there be good at you. So I resolved to go back someday and learn more Irish. And so I did when I was in my 20s. I lived in Galway, which was not far from Inishere, and studied Irish Gaelic at what is now called, what was then called University College Galway, is now National University of Ireland Galway. Anyway, so Tomé ag Lauert Gaelga Anish Lat. I'm now speaking Irish with you. So it's an extremely useful skill that has, that I've parlayed into fame and fortune, as you can see. And, so if you let me keep talking, you know, it's going to go from here out into beyond the observable universe. So rein me in, Scott.
Okay. I'm reeling you in, Chris. I've already learned a couple things about you that I didn't know before, which is really cool. I'm wondering, did your interest in being the wind lord, did that translate into your interest in physics, or how did you get interested in physics?
Yeah, I got interested in physics because I really liked math and got kind of far ahead in math, and came to calculus before coming to physics, and was fascinated to learn that calculus had been invented in order to do physics. Like one of the inventors, Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac, if you're frisky, Isaac invented calculus in order to express his physical laws. And I just found that fascinating, that math kind of worked in the real world to describe how the universe worked. I guess I knew that there was science, but I thought a lot of science was just naming things and kind of watching things before that. And then, whoa, wait a second, there are actual like mathematical laws underneath this all. And so I became really interested in learning more about those. Less to do it, to, you know, discover another particle or something like that. The sort of hunt for that didn't itself fascinate me as much as the fact that it's comprehensible at all, and also weirder than anyone possibly could have imagined. So each layer I peeled back as I learned more and more physics doing the degree was fascinating. And also like, okay, I want to teach other people about this rather than like go and try to hunt for the next like physical law underneath it all. But Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible at that level. I would say this to my students sometimes, like, you know, if I had created the universe, if I were sort of like dungeon master for the little, you know, the universe itself, I would be messing with it so much. The people would have no idea what was going on. Suddenly there'd be like, you know, like the electron would be positively charged or whatever, you know, like, and it would be like all weird.
There'd be unicorn trees.
And then suddenly there wouldn't be. And then they'd be back again, except double unicorn, because everybody wants a double unicorn. So yeah, it's still super mysterious and cool, and how the power of our thinking, which seems to be, you know, like just something that we inherit as humans, or that we're somehow born with, and then develop our logical skills to observe and to reason, then actually lead somewhere with the universe that like, oh, from a couple of postulates, Einstein comes up with the theory of relativity. And it's bizarre and it's cool. And like, so I just am in awe of both our ability to reason about the world and come up with the findings we have, and also about the world itself, that it's just really freaking cool.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear how people got into teaching, because my path to becoming a teacher was very unexpected. And get it talking about teaching, just briefly side journey, and then I want to get into Silver Quicken, but you know how Chris and I met, for our listeners. Chris, you were working for a company called Manhattan Prep, which, and you, one of the things that you did is you're a GMAT instructor. So you know, you have your MBA from Duke, and the GMAT is the test that people take when they're going to business school. It's the admission test for business school. I applied to Manhattan Prep to be an LSAT instructor, which is the test for law school. And just to give people a little background, the with Manhattan Prep, there was this long and torturous tribute to medieval torture that you had to go through just to get a job as a teacher there. You had to have a 99th percentile score just to send in your application, send in your resume. And then if you got accepted for the application process, there were like, I think, two or three online auditions you had to go through. If you managed to pass them, then they would fly you to New York for an in-person audition, which was like several hours of torture with several of the experienced instructors acting as your students and observing. And when I got flown in for my in-person audition, it just so happened that my audition was on Halloween. And I actually briefly thought, like, oh, should I wear a costume? Like, this seems like the crowd where I could get away with wearing a costume.
You could have. Yeah, could have. Yes.
And I didn't. I brought candy. I did bring candy, but I didn't wear a costume. However, I think most, or at least several of my evaluators did wear costumes, including you, Chris. You were dressed as, tell everybody.
I was dressed as Saul Goodman because it's Saul Goodman.
Yeah, so Saul Goodman comes walking out from Better Call Saul, and there you go.
And I don't know if I told you, did I tell you the story of that suit?
No. Oh, I think because, you did. You got to tell the story.
So I don't own a whole lot of suits. And at that point, I didn't own a whole lot of suits either. But that particular suit was this nice suit from like Ralph Lauren that I had gotten handed down to me from my brother, who then, when I told him this story not so long ago, he said he had gotten it, like there was some extra layers to the story where he had gotten it, which I don't recall now, but that suit went on its own journey, and I had gotten it back in the 90s from my brother. So here it is, you know, almost 20 years later, this suit has seen its better days, but it turned out to be kind of a good looking Saul Goodman suit. So I said, okay, I'm going to wear it. And I wore it that day with, you know, the worst tie and a bright orange shirt and everything. And partway through the day, Liz Kreischer, who I worked with, suddenly calls to me urgently and says, Chris. And I'm like, what? She says, your suit has ripped. Your pants have ripped. And in fact, they had ripped so incredibly that they were barely hanging on. This was the middle of the day. I'm not sure if we had had our meeting yet, or
I think mine was at the end of the day. This must have been before my audition.
So forgive me if I was a little distracted during your audition, because what I did was grab a stapler. Didn't have a sewing kit, so stapler will do, right? And I went into the bathroom and I stapled my suit back together, my suit pants. And let me just say that should be and was an emergency fix. You know, it's just you when you I'll leave it at that. You can just imagine my discomfort from that point forward during the day.
Yeah. I would imagine if you're, you know, heading to the Oscars in your Ralph Lauren suit, you don't want to have to grab a stapler and do an emergency repair like that.
This suit started at the top and ended up at the bottom. Sort of my bottom. Had to do it.
Thank you for sharing that story. I've heard that story before, and that's a good one. Okay, let's talk about Silver Quicken. Tell everybody about Silver Quicken, because this is such a cool thing, and I would love people to know about it.
Yeah, Silver Quicken does unique enrichment programs for third through eighth graders, and our thesis or mission is gifted education for everyone. The kind of cool, creative, challenging things that are often sort of behind the walls of gifted education reserved for kids who test into that. We feel like, hey, those kinds of things should be out there for everyone in some shape or form. And kids can do a lot more cool stuff than you imagine. So we take puzzles, games, and stories. Those are our sort of three ingredients of the pie. And the cool thing about each of those things is they're all, if they're well done, intrinsically motivating to kids. They're fun. That's what you lead with. So a puzzle is fun to solve. A game is fun to play and maybe even to win. And a story is fun to finish, to learn what happens next and imagine what happens next. And so all those things pull you forward naturally. It's so funny because you and I met through possibly the most extrinsically motivated side of education there is. Standardized tests, like right. They are extrinsically motivated. I'm doing this not because of the inherent love for the GMAT and the inherent love for the LSAT, but because I have to jump through the hoops. And I think one of the secret sauces that you and I applied while doing test prep is, hey, well, given that it's so extrinsically motivated, what can we find that's fun in it? What can we find that is actually kind of cool and self-motivating? Isn't it fun to work out this logic puzzle? Isn't it kind of like cool to learn this math that once upon a time you hated and now you're actually doing it and you're finding it kind of interesting? So we could surprise people into kind of discovering, one, the fun about it, and two, the like their own abilities when, you know, this extrinsically motivated thing is so stress producing. But we in SilverQuick can lead with things that are intrinsically motivating, fun, and then you can bake into it a lot of rigorous challenge. So a kid will work on a puzzle for days sometimes in one of our programs. The kinds of programs we do are after-school programs in person at different schools. And we also send kits home, kind of escape rooms in a box that allow kids all around the country, actually, to go on quests. We call that Quest Club. And each quest is a little story involving the SilverQuicken characters and involves a number of puzzles that the kids solve along the way with the SilverQuicken characters. So those are the things we're doing and it's going well. We're talking next week to the, depending on when you're listening to this, at some point to the National Association of Gifted Children, at the National Association for Gifted Children Conference about the power of puzzles. So we're trying to reinfuse joy and wonder into learning and really help sort of wake kids back up in a sense out of not just pandemic learning loss, but in general for some kids, school can be kind of a downer place in those years when you start to feel like you're being sorted, you start to feel like you're maybe falling short, and we're an avenue to have fun while you're learning and discover really cool things that you might not have known about.
And I can say we did get one of the Quest Club kits for our niece, Frances. My wife and I did. You got Frances's thumbs up of approval. I had seen firsthand that kids actually do find these interesting.
That's so meaningful. Thank you. Yes, we're excited about that.
I love what you're saying about bringing these tools and resources that are often reserved for gifted kids, or, you know, gifted kids are the ones who are exposed to this, and you're making that available for anyone.
Yeah. When you quote unquote are labeled gifted, after that point, you're in the club, right? So you get to go to some gifted pullout program, or there's some special things for you. And you're not in a sense being assessed at that point. You're just having fun learning and the teacher's bringing some cool things out. In fact, some of our Quest Clubs are used in gifted programs in various states. And so we're saying like, hey, you can be part of the Solvers Club. You can become a solver or a quester anywhere. And why not? So we feel like everybody ought to have that access, especially during those years, sort of like right after K-2, where you start to feel like, oh, school is starting to maybe push me and I'm starting to get grades and I'm starting to like take end of year tests. And I'm discovering that like oh, maybe I didn't do well on that math thing. Like, you know, for me, actually, Scott, when I was in third grade, my son is in third grade now. And when I was in third grade, I did terribly on times tables tests. Like, I would write out the 15, it would say 3 times 5, and I would take forever to write out the 15 because I'd write the 1 with the little hat and the foot, and then the 5 with the neck and the belly, and then come back for the head. And time's up. And I'm like, wait, I just like wrote 2 of these things. And the kid next to me had just like a slash and an S. And I'm like, that's not a 15, you know, whatever. And fortunately, one of my brothers was like, don't worry so much about those things. Yeah, you'll be fine. And by the way, I'm thinking of a number. And if I add 3 to it, I get 7. What's the number? And I'd say 4. And he said, you're doing algebra, dude, you're past this stuff. Like, you know, I'm writing that down as X plus 3 equals 7 or whatever. I'm like, what? I'm doing an X equals 4. And so he sort of allowed me to sidestep the judgment in my mind. But for so many kids, they get hit by that times tables test in school. And then they say, math sucks, or I suck at math, or both. And like, you know, and then that becomes a downward spiral, which actually relates to the time management thing, because it's very related to like procrastination. So yeah, you push off, you feel bad about doing that math homework at that point. And so, because you know that you're going to confront this thing that you don't like, and it's going to make you feel, it's going to challenge your sense of self. And so you push it off, and then that guilt gets wrapped further around that task. And so you again push it off by that part of you that's self-protective, that is like, that sort of like lizard part of your brain that's like, I don't care about the future. I don't know anything about the future. All I know about is right now. And there's a threat to Chris. There's a threat to Scott. And that threat, I'm going to push away. And for us, it means pushing away into the future, even though that's not adaptive, right? We know that. It's only going to make the thing worse, but that's the sort of spiral. And I recognize that. I struggle with that plenty.
And it's interesting, you know, when we talk about kids, you know, getting exposed to these experiences that lead to learning to procrastinate, you know, I had the same experience. I mean, I've talked about this before. I was, when I was younger, a quote, smart kid. I was in the gifted program. There were a lot of things that were really easy for me, or I was just interested in them. And if it was easy or it was interesting, I would just do it. And things that were hard or boring, I think because so many things were easy for me, when I ran into something that was difficult or boring, it just made me less interested in doing it. Like, I don't want to do this. This is hard. So I'd put it off and either wouldn't do it or do it at the last minute.
Yeah.
And that to me turned into this, you know, long-term habit of procrastinating, which I've eventually, you know, managed. But, you know, my big question is that I love to speak with educators about this. What can we do to help kids so that they're not like burdened by this throughout their educational life and then later in life too?
Yeah, it's a really, really great point. And I totally, totally hear you. Often the kids like you and I tested into gifted as well. And also found that I interpreted struggle as a negative thing. Mm-hmm. Struggle meant that, one, I was not used to struggling because so much of regular schoolwork was quote unquote easy for me. So I just zipped through it and turned it in, except for those times tables tests, but the rest of it was simple. And I took a struggle to mean, oh, I shouldn't do this, and didn't learn how to struggle. So that's one of the things we do in Silver Quicken is we're trying to normalize struggle. And we find, especially with are the gifted kids who are doing Silver Quicken stuff, it's a struggle, especially if they're doubly, where they've also got some other exceptionalities in addition to their giftedness. It can be really hard for them at first to learn to struggle. You said 2 adjectives. You encountered something hard or something boring. And what we're trying to do in Silver Quicken is often tease them apart to say, this thing's hard, but it's super interesting. Right. So we're going to trap you. We're going to honeypot you Scott, you're going to like just get pulled into doing this puzzle. That's the power of puzzle. That's what we're talking about. It's like, we want something that's really hard, but that's also attractive and sort of blends this thing together where like, ooh, I want to figure that out. And it gives you little breadcrumbs along the way. Some of what I think the answer to your question is we've got to redesign things that kids are encountering. We either ask them to do boring, easy stuff. And actually a lot of the stuff that we do is sort of grunt work. We don't really ask kids to struggle in school enough, struggle in the right ways with guidance. And then we don't make the tasks that are really hard, that are really tough to figure out. We don't give enough guidance and we don't make them inherently attractive enough. I think there's use absolutely for the extrinsic motivation in school. You know, our friend Dan Gonzalez is all about like, hey, let's have kids see how this translates into, let's have them do real things in the real world. They can do more things that are useful. I completely agree with that. But I also think that there are things that just need to be fun for their own sake, and especially early on at the ages I'm talking about, like third through eighth grade, we need to redesign both the tasks and the teaching such that we have hard and fascinating stuff at the same time. The boring stuff, we should try to like minimize. Easy stuff, well, we got to find that right sort of like Vygotsky's zone of proximal development where you get into a flow state, meaning, oh, this is hard, but not super frustrating for me. The boring end or the frustrating end. How can we widen that middle where I'm going to keep engaging with this and get into a flow state? And hopefully that's with some other people. It's also about teasing out the sort of like value judgments and trying to, that's one of the other powers of puzzles. It's like, hey, this isn't an assessment. It's sort of silly. There's a game playing aspect to it, which allows you to have less ego and sort of like your own self and your identity is not at stake with this puzzle as much. So if we can sort of lower the stakes, increase the fun factor and tie it to things that are hard, then we can get kids to get used to more struggle. And then that gets to the procrastination, because if we normalize struggle and we have kids feel good about struggle, it's like, and a lot of times we use, I think some of our extracurricular activities that we have kids do are sort of the best models for them. We have sports, we have drama, we have all kinds of other sorts of clubs where we learn practice makes better. And hey, we got to put in some work and so forth. And we see it, they see sort of that growth through productive struggle. Those metaphors you bring back to academics, wouldn't it be great if academics were kind of structured that way to begin with?
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, we're going to cover this chapter, we're going to do it really fast, and then I'm going to test you on it. And if you didn't miss it, you didn't get it, okay, well, on to the next chapter. And we have this like super broad coverage. Gosh, Scott, I struggle with procrastination to this day. It's like, it's almost like I've come to realize like I don't want to make an inappropriate analogy, but it is the kind of thing where I feel like this is both a strength and a weakness for me, that I have low walls and I'm distractible. So when you're introducing me, I'm going to immediately go off on some tangent. That is a source of power for me to help create Silver Quicken. And a lot of our kids have low walls as well, where they're going to see connections between things. And they should see that as a power and as a strength, but also set up systems to counteract it and recognize, okay, well, that's like, you know, sometimes I'm a fish and sometimes I'm in water and sometimes I need a bird to carry the bowl with me in it through the air.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I need a fish tank on wheels to get
I need a fish tank on wheels. Other.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, trying to walk as the fish, well, maybe some of our distant ancestors did that and good for them. But like, you know, if I'm really a fish, or conversely, I'm really a bird, I need like a submarine that's big enough for me to flap around in. And I just need help. And I need that help from a system. I need that help from And that is extrinsic, that will need to be extrinsic, but chosen in an intrinsic kind of way, something that works for me, that I feel passionate about, and that I can sort of like work my way into. You know, one way that I try to do it is I, you know, rely on my systems, rely on scheduling software, just like literally putting it into, you know, the Google Calendar on the spot. Trying to have a good net for, especially on the creative side, I always walk around, and your listeners can imagine this, I always walk around with at least one mechanical pencil, usually more than one, and a notebook, a Moleskine notebook. This is a system that I've used for many, many years. I'm looking up at a dozen. The point for me of these Moleskine notebooks is that I have a net that captures something wherever I am, and it's not my phone. Because if I touch my phone, then the infinite possibility of the internet opens up, and of messages and of email and of the web and of the app and of the whatever. Whereas this is paper. Yeah. This is pure paper. All that can go on it is whatever my immediate note is. So there's a fictional story inside Silver Quicken that I'm turning into the first of hopefully a series of novels. And for that process to work, I've never written a novel before. I've written pieces of this novel, over 100,000 words and counting. But the point is that it's super terrifying for me. And I've got to juggle it with everything else, not only within Silver Quicken of like, okay, I've got to get in touch with this school and work with so-and-so on, you know, a variety of things, but also home life and everything else in my life. What reassures me, what a system that works for me, is to have this notebook at the ready at all times, such that I know that if I have a thought, and that's how some of the best thoughts come to me as a low walls kind of person, I'm doing something else, I'm like, oh yeah, so-and-so, this one character says, I remember the boy who dreamt her. I'm like, that's that. I need to put that point in. And so this one character says that. I wrote it down here. I would have written it down in my notebook, but now it's going into this big outline processor. That's another tool that I use. An outline processor. These are funny things that existed. They kind of had their heyday from 1985 to 1995 and got steamrolled out of existence, or nearly out of existence, by Microsoft Word. What an outline processor allows you to do is basically accordion ideas up and down. You think like, why doesn't Word, you just make an outline in Word? The problem is it's fine to make an outline in Word if you already know what the outline is going to, how it's going to be organized and where everything goes. But if you're trying to structure as you go, you need a different tool, because you can't collapse everything up into a little tiny piece and then drag it into a different place in your massive outline. So I have two massive outlines within an outline processor called Inspiration. And this thing survived the steamrolling of Microsoft Word by hiding out in education, because it's also a graphical organizer, like mind mapping and stuff like that. I never use the mind mapping side of it. I use purely the outlining. And in fact, another former end prepper who's written a number of screenplays, he and I years ago both like grooved on, hey, you use an outline processor too for your creative writing and so forth, because it allows you to, I have one that's my novel outline, and I can go as deep as I want and then close up and look at any level in any collapsed way or restructured in any kind of way I want. And then I have another one that's the Encyclopedia Argento Celeritatur, which means Silver Quicken in Latin. and hey, it's Chris, my encyclopedia.
Let me pause you for a second, because you're rolling, which is awesome. And there are some awesome things that you just mentioned that I really want to highlight and recap. I want to make sure that people who are listening walk away with this to think about a little bit. One is, you talked about the way we perceive struggle, which I think is so important, because we do, I think there is a tendency, and maybe this is a normal human like psychological tendency, to view struggle as bad.
Yeah.
You know, struggle is bad, you know, and then when we face challenges and we feel that sense of struggle, we associate it with bad feelings, bad emotions.
And there's imposter syndrome if you are part of a group that, you know, labeled gifted or labeled advanced, and all of a sudden you're struggling with the next level, then you might think, oh, I don't belong in this group anymore.
Because, and that's the, I think that's part of it, is that's the message that gets reinforced, because we look at the people who don't have to struggle as the gifted ones, and the people who are struggling, rather than saying, hey, you're struggling, that's great. You're probably going to learn something if you
even think of that word, struggling. You're struggling. That could be a super positive thing, but we mean that like, wow, you're about to drown.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think it's just normalizing struggle and recognizing it as something valuable.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things I really enjoy doing on this show, is to have someone who's, yes, has the MBA from Duke and the degree in physics from Harvard, and to hear you say, oh yeah, procrastination, that's like a big deal. Like, and you know, that you also struggle with these same things.
Oh my goodness. I barely got my physics degree from Harvard, I ran into this buzzsaw, because I aced high school my first year of Harvard. I was far ahead in math and physics, so I aced those classes. And one of those classes was set up in a way that was terrible for me personally for this tendency. It had what were called resurrection points, which means any homework assignment or any quiz or any test that you didn't, any points you didn't get on those things, came back on the final. So you could make the final worth 100% of your grade.
Wow.
And one class I pulled out an A from that freshman year.
Let's reinforce procrastinating.
And so then I kept treating, in my junior year, I treated some classes as if they had resurrection finals, which didn't have resurrection finals. And I remember my thermodynamics professor said to me, you got an A on the final. Why didn't you turn in your homework? I have to give you this C. And I'm like, I know. And I can viscerally feel the shame that came about through another class that I also bombed and got the lowest grade in that class. It was posted on this Nobel Prize laureate's door and everything. And so, and then I managed to come back and get out of there with an honors level. But it was junior year, I had totally fallen into procrastinate, and you can pull it all back on the final, even when that's a terrible strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talked about systems too, your notebook. I mean, this to me seems like an important piece of it, because when I'm working with adults, when I'm coaching adults who want to improve their time management skills, that's a lot of what we talk about. And, you know, I might suggest different systems like bullet journaling, like time blocking on a Google Calendar. You know, there are lots of great systems out there. It's funny that you mentioned the outline processors, because when I talk, if people ask me about apps, one of the most useful ones that I found is called Task Paper, which is basically, it's for Mac and for iPad. It's an outline processor, and it simulates, you know, making outlines on paper. But the idea is, we encourage people to try these things and then find the system that works for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is an important question for educators, for the K-12 world. How do we start teaching some of these systems or sharing some of these systems with younger kids who, when they start showing signs that they would benefit from this, like, hey, you do really well in some of these things, but you could really benefit from learning a way to handle the assignments that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I think is starting to happen, but it's happening very slowly in education.
Yeah, that's right. My kids go to a Montessori school, and Montessori is really great as a philosophy overall in putting the responsibility on kids and developing executive function. And it's hard that they have work plans and they do their works and they develop their work plans. And I'm trying to work with my son now, like he sort of peters out through the week. So his Monday work plan and Tuesday look good. And then by the time Thursday and Friday come around, it's like a couple of things on there that he's done.
Chris,
that's hard. Yeah.
Chris, how do we silver quicken the work plans? How do we make it interesting and intrinsically motivating? And so that the kids go, oh yeah, let me make my work plan for the week. That's going to be really cool.
Yeah. some of it is just sprinkling the magic fairy dust on it. This is a great idea, Scott. And silver quicken is a verb, by the way. It means to put magic into something. At least that's how we made it up. How do we silver quicken it?
That's kind of, that could be like a question for long-term thought.
Yeah, let's come back to this. You know, when we, you know, in round two of this this pod, we'll talk about it. But I that is super great food for thought. How do we make a work plan intrinsically interesting or just sort of fun to start to do? And sometimes it's about, as I'm sure you talked about a lot, like cracking the seal. Once you get into it, you're like, oh, this wasn't so bad. But it's like getting over that hump of the activation energy to sit down and do it. So how do we give kids a way in and an immediate reward for having started the thing?
Yeah, because that's what it's about, right? Immediate reward. And even just getting started, I find with so many tasks that are easy for me to put off because I really don't want to do them. At least once I get started, then it's not a problem, right? Then the inertia takes over. And, you know, the psychological Sir Isaac Newton, you know, inertia takes over. And then, yeah, we just do it. So how do we get it started is often such an important question, I think, for kids, too. I want to be respectful of your time, Chris. I know we scheduled a certain amount of time for this. I would love to have you back because there are so many other things I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about bicycling when you're 14 across Ireland and like, what do you remember about how that affected your sense of time? Because like I've done long trips like that away from civilization and it kind of sense of time shifts, you know?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Well, you definitely got to come back, Chris, because also I want to talk to you about time from a physics standpoint.
Oh, goodness.
And time, more about time from a CEO and founder,
yes,
co-founder standpoint and, you know, all these good things. Before we go for today, I have a question that I always ask people at the end of this podcast, which is, what is your dream right now?
What is my dream right now? My dream right now is to get the revised version of the Silver Quicken novel done by a certain time in 2023, which I won't... I won't commit to on this podcast.
That's okay.
I want to, but I, and it's very daunting, but also super energizing. So I go back and forth between measuring it and not measuring it. And it takes place in a dream world. That's both the act of writing this fiction and the fiction itself is about a dream school, a school in the dream world, which is Silver Quicken. So, on all those kind of ways, when you say the word dream to me, I'm immediately pulled to the Silver Quicken dream world where kids learn to manipulate their dreaming powers, what we call swevening inside that fictional universe, which is an old English word for dreaming. And they learn to manipulate their dreams and to solve puzzles that have been baked into that dream world by previous generations of kids. And at the same time, everybody's got nightmares. And so on the edges of this world lurk those nightmares and the challenges that come from them. So dream, that word has a lot of resonance for me these days, Scott.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like it. Chris, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that? Or if they want to learn more about Silver Quicken, how do they do that?
Well, go to our website, silverquicken.com. It's all one word, silverquicken. And they can email me at chris.ryan@silverquicken.com.
Okay, awesome. And I'll put those in the show notes too. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so grateful for you being here today. I'm sure people are going to enjoy this and look forward to doing this again sometime. I really would like to have you back on another episode.
Yeah, we've got more to delve into. Physics time, CEO time. We will manage it all.
If you were listening to some of the things that Chris talked about and they sounded really familiar to you, so maybe you or someone you know is a student or a teacher or an entrepreneur or doing something else where you've been successful in a lot of ways, but maybe you're still
struggling with procrastination a little bit, or you're looking for better systems to help you manage your time. Maybe you would like more time in your life for things that you enjoy, like writing or other creative endeavors. I love helping people with these kinds of things. So if you're looking for help, check out my website, scottmillercoaching.com, or send me an email, scott@scottmillercoaching.com. And we hope you will join us for more episodes of Task Time Energy, the Purpose-Filled Productivity Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on other podcast players. Click that follow button or like button or subscribe button or whatever it says on your podcast player. And come on back and join us for the next episode.